Yeah, that would, you know.
What about you, Sarah?
Well, I was like, oh, I'm going to be a vampire, you know. And then I was like, oh, that's so boring. Then I thought, oh, I want to be like a Jezebel and wear like, you know, cardinals, like evil, be an evil cardinal, you know, like a Catholic cardinal in red robes. Like, kind of like a Jezebel, weird cardinal. But usually what I do on Halloween is like carve a pumpkin by myself. And just lock all the doors and windows and just like hang out by myself.
Oh. Pretend you're not home.
Pretend I'm not home. Curse the teenagers that are setting off firecrackers. Oh, and so
I used to be one of them.
But anyways, I guess we're kind of out of time. I'm so glad you came, James.
Oh,
that's
thanks for
awesome.
Having me, guys. It's always such a treat.
And I thought I'd leave off with a song by Arcade Fire called Joan of Arc.
Yay!
I've never heard this song, so I don't
Neither
know what
I.
to expect.
But I like Arcade Fire.
I don't know. I've just like not really ever checked them out that much. Considering how huge they are, that's a bit of an oversight on my part. But we are going to do UBC Arts on Air, so stay tuned after this. And why don't you guys say goodbye?
Goodbye.
See y'all next time.
Yeah, for sure. We'll be back next week. Talking about other things, and so keep on rocking. Here's Arcade Fire by doing Joan of Arc, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. You're the one that they used to hate, but they like you now, and everything that goes away with the dirt somehow. They're the ones that spit on you, cause they got your heart. I'm the one that will follow you, you're my Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc. You had a vision they couldn't see, so they put you down. But everything that you said would happen, it came all around. Follow you.
Oh my. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at...
The Baker and the Chef, Bangone T-Shirts, Cherry Bomb, House of Vintage, Beat Street Records, Downlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Song Club, His Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save on Meats, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gayla Kasla. My name is Gennargio Sullivan of the Tlaweitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
My name is Isabel Francis, and my husband was Louis Francis, who died in 1971. And he went to school in Spanish. My husband was up there till he was 16. And his sister was up there till she was 16. She left 2 years before he did. And he had a younger sister and a younger brother that...
From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. Today, Professor Henry Davis of the Department of Linguistics, who is applying some new techniques to the teaching of the subject. Henry, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's begin with the study of linguistics. A rather small question to begin, but how has the teaching of it changed, say, over the last 10 years or so? Or hasn't it?
It has begun to change. The field is a very rapidly changing field. So it's a field whose kind of leading edge is moving fast. And so partly because it's a relatively new field with a long history, but a series of really kind of spectacular revolutions. Everybody who knows about linguistics has heard of Chomsky, and we talk about the Chomskyan revolution as really something that overturned everything in linguistics. In fact, there have been about three Chomskyan revolutions, and every time one of these has happened, people have taken a different direction. So the actual material that we have taught changes all the time, and so does the methodology, and so do our relations to other disciplines, because linguistics sits in the kind of cusp of a kind of interdisciplinary set of concerns about language. And actually, how I got into linguistics was I began academically as an English major, or the first part of an English tripos, which is a tripos in Cambridge is two parts. Then I switched, dissatisfied with kind of the semiotic world that I ended up in, to studying mostly philosophy and psychology, but I was really interested in language. And so I circled around linguistics for several years as an undergraduate. And at that point in the UK, very often in the UK, it was a very rich British empiricist tradition, which resisted the Chomskyan revolution to the end, and still does in some parts of it. Right? So eventually, I was able to do one linguistics course as an undergraduate, and then had to basically go to North America to continue my education as a linguist. So linguistics is a discipline that sits in the middle of psychology, philosophy, literature, languages, computer science has been very important in it, and so we have to continue shift our ground and what we do. So that's the content the way we teach, obviously, the way that anybody teaches is now shifting as classes get bigger, as technology becomes more important, partly as an aid to teaching bigger classes, but partly because it's useful in and of itself. And also the students change. And that's the most important thing, I think, now that's happening, is that we must catch up with what students know and what they don't know, because it's a different skill set.
So you mentioned computer science and technology. Have they played a critical role in both the content and the delivery of linguistics? Because my impression of linguistics, and I know it's incomplete and probably incorrect, is that it can be a terrifically technical subject.
It is a terrifically technical subject, and actually there are several technologies that it can draw from. So psycholinguists, for example, draw on psychological experimental techniques, and that's very important. But computer science is very important as the foundation of linguistics. Everybody knows about Chomsky, but most people don't know that actually what Chomsky did was take work from Turing, who you probably another kind of very famous figure for academic and non-academic reasons, take Turing's spectacularly brilliant results and apply them to natural language, which was in and of itself a spectacularly brilliant move. That actually founded both modern linguistics, but also it's one of the fundamental planks on which computer science builds, this theory of formal languages, because computers, really what they are is linguistic machines in some sense, not human linguistic machines, but linguistic machines for all that. So yes, so intellectual foundations very close to computer science. Yeah.
Well, what led you to the field in the first place? You've kind of given a descriptive history of, well, it wasn't the kind of approach you wanted, at least in the UK. You come to the States. But what kind of pulled you in?
Well, my own personal very zigzagging journey is unusual maybe academically, but it's not unusual amongst linguists, because nobody at the age of 10 wants to be a linguist because they don't even know what it is. And actually high school students don't know what linguistics is to a large extent, though we're trying to change that. We're actually kind of pushing to have linguistics go down in the academic for high school students. But mostly, there's no single path for linguists. They come from science backgrounds, they come from arts backgrounds, they come from language backgrounds, all kinds of things. So you can also come at it from a philosophical viewpoint, from all kinds of ways. I came at it, actually, as a certain generation of people probably did, from Chomsky's politics. And So when I was in Cambridge, I was a pretty hardcore anarchist until I went to a large anarchist conference, which was anarchical. On the other hand, so I was interested. I was reading a lot of anarchist stuff, and Chomsky, of course, was at that point one of the leading figures in that world. And so I was a guy in Cambridge who was simultaneously an anarchist and a linguist. So I became interested in Chomsky's political writing. Then I started to read his linguistic stuff because I was also interested in language, and the two kind of coalesced and I became interested. I actually hated Chomsky's linguistics when I began. Lots of people get into something because they want to show that it's stupid, and once they get into it, they realize that it's not at all stupid. In fact, you know, the nice thing I found about Chomsky versus, say, Derrida or Lacan was it was hard in the right way. So, you know, you worked at it, it got easier, as opposed to you worked at it and it kind of disappeared in your hands.
So what did you discover when you came to North America, and where did you study?
I studied here. And the reason I came here was kind of unlinguistic. The other thing that was happening when I came to North America was the kind of Thatcherite political revolution. At the time I left, it was the kind of anarchy in the UK phase, and it looked pretty, this was real anarchy, right? So not, you know, not the genteel kind where we all sit around and talk about syndicalism, but the kind where, you know, the streets are burning down. And the last two places I lived were, by some coincidence, both burnt to the ground. One was in Liverpool, one was in Dalston Junction in London. And so things looked pretty grim. You either were going to have the Thatcherite revolution succeed, or it was going to fail, and neither were good. And of course, what happened was it succeeded. And I swore that I would never return to the UK until Thatcher was gone. And unfortunately, she's still here. She's and has spread around the world. And so there's not very many places to go to avoid it, though. So, but that's how I came here. And I kind of cashed in my Cambridge degree for a North American one. And I had no intention of leaping from the arms of Thatcher into the welcoming embrace of Ronald Reagan at that point. So that's why I chose Canada. And then there were various academic and non-academic reasons why I ended up in Vancouver.
You know, I believe Dave, and you referred to the zigzag earlier, I must ask you about your, and I admire this tremendously, professional life as a clown.
Yeah, so all the way, well, here's the beginning, is I kind of left home with you know, some, in some dungeon at the age of 17, and my also my, I walked out of my high school, and ended up in London kicking around, and by total happenstance ended up looking after kids while their parents were rehearsing, and their parents were a group, were a troupe of clowns. At that point, there was the kind of the revival of the clowning tradition outside the circus. It was a very interesting time to be doing that kind of stuff, because it was still the period in the UK when Arts Council subsidies were subsidizing quite a lot of alternative theatre, and there was a big revival of clowns. So, you know, to put a kind of long story short, I ended up kind of not being a very good babysitter, not being a very good stage manager, and ending up on the stage myself by kind of learning it, you know, as a trade. And a very useful, spectacularly difficult thing to do. It makes academics seem very easy to be a good clown. I maintained my my clowning profession all the way through, kind of until I got into the kind of tenure phase of academia, at which point two things happen, one of which academic life gets very intense. The other thing is you begin to break as a clown because you are falling over for a living. So, you know, I have a bone spur in my hip and a separated shoulder and this or that. And, of course, you know, you are not a rock star, so you're not earning very much money, and kind of spare change becomes tiring at some point. You know, it's a life I loved and hated in equal measure, but there is no more sublime moment than when you get it right as a clown, really. The only thing you can compare it to is, you know, when you hit the right notes as a jazz musician, which is, you know, it's not something that happens all the time, right?
So have you carried over this focus on sort of the performative into the classroom in some way? Can you elaborate?
So, large classes. Basically, my kind of rule of when you move from a teacher to a performer is around 140. That's a very magic number, because 140, turns out, is also the same number of people that you can maintain on Facebook as real friends. And it's also the average size of a community in a kind of pre-agrarian society. 140 people is your community, basically. So below 140, you can know everybody in some sense, right? Above 140, you're performing, and you're on stage, and so then you go into performance mode. And it's a shame in a sense that, you know, teachers of large classes at UBC and any other, you know, big university have no training. It is a set of techniques that you learn to use. You're big. Here I am being big on the radio, so you can't see me. But you know, you can get across certain points, and you can't get across anything very subtle. It's the difference between being in a movie and being on stage. And so, of course, all of those techniques of clowning are extremely applicable. And I'm lucky I had that background, basically.
So can you be a touch more specific? If I come to you and say, I have a large class, I have 160, what are one or two things I might be able to do on the performative side that would make my teaching more effective? And don't include PowerPoint.
This is not what I suggest for anybody, but I run around the classroom a whole lot. I do not stand in one place. You have to move, you have to break things up in a way that enables people not to kind of zone out and go into their electronic world, or actually daydream or fall asleep. Right? When I teach large classes, I always try to break them up into bits. The class I just taught in the spring was under the aegis of this thing called flexible learning. Well, nobody actually knew what they were doing when they started the flexible learning initiative, which in a way, for somebody like me, was great, right? So I asked Janet Giltrow, who's in the arts, who's the undergraduate dean, what does it mean? And she says, I don't know, make it up, right? So I did, right? And this was, for some people, this is terrifying. For me, it's a license to do what I felt like. So I actually had the whole class perform at the end of the class. I scrapped the exam system, scrapped note-taking, told them all they could not bring anything into the classroom except themselves, and made it into a much more human experience. Because that's what, you know, theater is one thing, but I wanted to break the fourth wall, as we do when we're clowning, as opposed to when we're performing for an audience. And so that's very specific technique to clowning. You have to get in their faces, and you have to get them interacting with you in a much more direct way. That brings people in. It makes them part of that whole performance, as opposed to being spectators. And the reason I did this was because I actually asked students, because I've taught these low-level classes before. And one thing that, you know, with all due respect, UBC isn't very bad at actually asking students what they want. And I don't mean electronic surveys with checking boxes and like, dislike. I mean, there's tons of evaluations here and there. But how many people actually sit down with students and ask them? And I was very interested in the lecture format. I said, okay, why are you guys coming in from Port Coquitlam or, you know, the further reaches of Surrey, spending, you know, 4 hours on a bus, some of these guys, right, to come here? And they said, because we like the human aspect of it, right? So as opposed to the kind of general thrust towards putting more and more things online, I think the reason universities are here is because we have human face-to-face contact of some kind. So as opposed to emphasizing the electronic part, I wanted to emphasize the human part. So I made it into much more of a theatrical enterprise and more of an interactive theatrical enterprise, so which was very successful. In particular, the kind of project at the end, they just had to perform some linguistics. I mean, they had to think it up. They ended up, you know, making costumes. I mean, everything from puppetry to, you know, very spectacularly well-produced videos. Because the other thing that we forget is, you know, like most people of my generation, I'm not particularly good at the technology. And you know, I learn it when I have to, but it doesn't come naturally. The guys that we're teaching now, these 18-year-olds, they all know how to video edit. They all, you know, they spend huge amounts of their time online. They're brought up with that. So why are we trying to do for them things that they do much more naturally and better themselves? And so I think it's a question of using the skills that they have, not trying to replicate that ourselves badly, just makes us look stupid, and do what we do well, which is actually the kind of teaching that we've always done very well and that most of us enjoy most, which is face-to-face teaching. And that's what the students, I think, want. That's why they're here. They're here for an experience, both with their peers, but also with their TAs and with their instructors.
Okay, let's change direction a little bit and talk about your an aspect of your research, which has essentially been focusing on native language of the Salish people. How did this come about?
It's a conjunction in a sense, right? So we've been talking about my theatrical side of things. So I'm like an accidental academic in some way. It's a very hard thing to do these days, but it's a very good thing to be, I think, because anybody who's an academic should have one foot planted firmly in some other world. My foot has been planted firmly on Indian reserves for, you know, many years now, and that might seem a kind of very zigzag part, but it relates very closely to what I did as a clown, because if you think about marginal populations, clowns are marginal. In our society, First Nations people are marginal. Not by choice, but by history. And but they have a lot of the really positive attributes of the marginal. They think in a different way. They are critical in a way that comes from an outsider perspective. And, you know, I'm a maverick. I'm an outsider. So to be inside an institution, I need to have one foot in an outside community and, in a sense, be an advocate for that community, which is what I am as a linguist to a certain extent. So so when I made that transition, my PhD was actually on language acquisition. I worked with three-year-olds. And so I really did another zigzag in my academic career. I shifted towards working with basically elders, because at this point in the decline of First Nations languages in British Columbia, we're at a stage where nearly all of the speakers of the languages were raised in the language before the Second World War. There's a very clear point at which the residential school system was essentially tasked by the government to eliminate languages very successfully. That was after the Second World War. So I start with three-year-olds. I'm now working with kind of 83-year-olds largely. But but the transition wasn't very difficult for me. I'm very much at home in First Nations communities. It doesn't mean that I am a First Nations person. It means that I'm kind of fly on the wall lots of the time. And I love working with those people for very, very many reasons, for their courage, for their ability to survive, for their sense of who they are on the land, for the fact that, you know, these are the people who were originally here, and so on. So that's what I do. And, it's where I found myself at home academically.
So, but is this kind of work a question of preservation and continuation, or is it sort of investigation?
It's both. So this is something that very often comes up in actually the field. So I'm a kind of formal analytical linguist. But at the same time, the techniques that I use to analyze languages are really ways of exploring people's heads in a certain way. So where does language sit? For us linguists, it sits in the heads of individual speakers. Not out there. It's not a corpus. It's not a body of work. It's not a set of experimental results. It's really a particular kind of knowledge that speakers of a language have. And the speakers of First Nations languages have different knowledge than the speakers of Western European languages. Very different. And so one of the things that I was lucky enough to be able to do when I first started working on the language that I mostly work on, which is a language called Atlin Chich, which is Lowat. Those of you who've been to Whistler, Whistler is in Lowat territory. And I work actually in the town of Lowat, which is exactly twice as far as Whistler from Vancouver. But the what I set out to do was actually learn the language as well as best I could at that point. And I was very lucky because I ended up teaching it because I was working for SFU at the point. And at that point, and SFU pioneered the idea that one could teach First Nations languages in the communities as opposed to bringing them out and putting them in the university setting. So I ended up teaching an SFU, well, several SFU courses in Lua. I was nominally the instructor, but I knew far less about the language than my TAs, who were really the teachers. And so they sat me down, these three fierce old ladies, and said, want to learn our language? We want to teach our language. You better learn it quite quick. So I was kind of 2 weeks ahead of my class, and you know, dealing with the sound system, which is spectacularly difficult, and the grammar, which is very different, and so on and so forth. But the education was exactly, absolutely what I needed. So then, okay, you get into you're trying to get into the heads of what it is like to speak this language. The Weltanschauung that goes with it is, in a sense, and certainly the cognitive. The cognitive frame with which you view the universe. Right?
Is there some issue about a dictionary of this language?
There's for all of these languages. So for those of you who don't know, there are 26 different First Nations languages from six or seven different families in BC. It's a considerably richer linguistic heritage than Europe, for example. So we're in a spectacularly important linguistic part of the world with every single language slated to lose the last of its first language speakers within the next generation. You know, anything from, you know, a year or so to 25 years at the utmost, right? So what do we do? Well, it's not the case that the next generations of speakers, of potential speakers, are uninterested. They're extremely interested. They're extremely interested because they understand exactly what language means. It means identity to all of these little language groups. What distinguishes them now is their language, and of course the language contains also their literature, their technology, everything else, because these are oral languages. So what we do is we try and best prepare the ground for the phase which is coming when there will no longer be, you know, your grandmother won't be around to correct you. There won't be an aunt who knows this word or that word. And so that's the documentary part of what we do. And obviously dictionaries is part of this, grammars is part of this, text is part of this, but also actually, you know, kind of really hardcore linguistic elicitation, what we call kind of little experiments on people's minds, right? To see, okay, do you do this differently from the way you would do it in English? And very often it is the case that they do things differently.
You're making this all sound fantastically exciting.
Well, it is. It's also, you know, it's also very sad because I, frankly, you know, I go to a lot of funerals. Most of the people I started working with, you know, decades ago have now passed on because you start working with elders. So it's tremendous responsibility. It's a tremendous privilege. But it's also, you know, there is a somber aspect to it. And for me, you know, one gets very close to one's consultants. I ended up in, when I started working with Lua, I thought I'd do this for a couple of years, and then I thought, you know, my elders are still around, and at some point, you know, one of my elders said, well, they're not going anywhere until we do, right? And so I have to basically see them through to the end. And you have to also remember that, you know, First Nations elders now working on their languages are at the end of, you know, often extremely difficult, hard lives. No, you know, these are people who have had no privileges. They've been at the bottom of our social structure. And at the very end of their lives, tired as they are, they're struggling as best they can to make sure that what they know gets passed on. And you know, given that, what do? You have no, you know, I really had no choice but to this day, and of course I benefit from it, but it's also, you know, it's an obligation. So it's a rich experience, right? It's not a dry academic life. Right?
It's been a great pleasure to talk to you today.
You too. So thank you very much.
Professor Henry Davis, the Department of Linguistics at UBC, thank you again for joining us on UBC Arts on Air, and stay tuned for future interviews focusing on new approaches to the arts. Thank you again.
All right, that right there was the Modernettes with the song Barbara. And the Modernettes are a band out of Vancouver from like the late 70s era, part of that whole punk rock movement. What can I tell you about the Modernettes? Okay, hold on, sweetie. No, not right now. Not right now. Okay, so I'm here with my kids, as I lately have been. Let me tell you a little bit about the Modernettes. My name, by the way, is Anita B, and this is my show here, Sam Squanch's Hideaway. I believe not long ago, like as in the last, you know, sort of like 6-7 years, the Modernettes did get back together, some sort of reunion show at least. I didn't see it, but I saw some reviews. And let's see. Let me tell you about the Modernettes. They, that song Barbara that we heard originally appeared on the Modernettes Teen City 12-inch EP, on Quintessence Records, all right? And they actually released a video of that song right when videos first came out. And that was in the early 80s. They were a trio, and the guitar player played a 5-string guitar, and a 3-string bass was played by the bass player, of course. And then they broke up a year after the release of their record Teen City. And there you go. That is the Modernettes for you. My show here, Sam Squanch's Hideaway, is all about Canadian music, and I'm here with you all until 8 o'clock. So we are going to move on with some more of that. This is a band, that I quite like. They're local and they have a new record out. It's called Well, it's self-titled, and it was just released over a month ago. I'm talking about Dead Soft. They're actually on tour right now. I follow them on Twitter, so you can do that too. I want to say they're like maybe in Alberta right now. Anyways, yeah, I saw them not long ago, just last month. No, yeah, barely, like a couple weeks ago, play with the Beelines and who else? Oh, Sean Mrazek's band, his band. And who was the other band? The Invasives at Redgate. And it was a really good show. It was Dead Soft's, I think it was their tour kickoff show. And they also played the CITR block party deal back at the end of August. And anyways, we're going to hear something from their new record. This song is called Emergency. And this record is new. Okay. So these guys are local. And here you go. The station, of course, is CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We'll be right back.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siam Nisiam Nisiaya, and the Skakuya to lead Tim Homasquim Mustayo.
The Westside Community Food Market is a small farmers market located on West 8th Avenue and Vine Street, where you can find a myriad of local organic produce and gourmet homemade treats like canned black currant jelly or freshly baked bread. Every Thursday from 3 to 6 p.m. until September 19th, and is sponsored by Society Promoting Environmental Conversation and Kids Neighborhood House.
All right, that right there was the Constantines. And the Constantines are a band out of, I want to say Guelph, Ontario. I know that's where they are. That's actually my alma mater. I went to the University of Guelph, got my first degree there. And they are the people that had the label Three Gut Records. And we heard the song Young Lions off of the 2003 release from their label entitled Shine a Light. They also had at least from off the top of my head, some at least one Sub Pop release. I'm not sure how many more. So they're Sub Pop people and they did their own thing. And interestingly enough, tonight, folks, the Constantines are playing at the Commodore and Lady Hawk is opening. So you could probably still go get some tickets. And I would love to be at that show. I'm a huge Constantines and Lady Hawk fan. Actually, I'm a massive, massive Lady Hawk fan. The lead singer of Lady Hawk, his voice is like one of my favorite rock voices of all. I just adore them. And so I'm going to play some Lady Hawk next. But before the Constantines, we heard the song Do You Know Who I Am, which is from the Vancouver band The Beelines, from their new record, Opening Band. And they are on, they have their own label. It's called Hockey Dad Records. And yeah, I told you I saw them. Yeah, with Dead Soft, actually. And it was a great show. It was actually, it was good. Very young. I think it must have been an all-ages show. It was at Redgate. And I sometimes forget. I think it might have been an all-ages show because it was like really like, I was like, this guy looks like he's 15. And he probably now in retrospect was. So that was a hyper exaggeration of age probably. So anyways, yeah. And Dead Soft we heard in there with the song Emergency from their new record Dead Soft, which is self-titled. It is 6:49. My name is Anita B, and this is my show, Sam Squanch's Hideaway, on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. And what can I tell you? I can tell you that, well, it's October 8th. What's coming up? There's some good shows coming up, actually. Let's see. I'll tell you what shows I'm excited about. I'm excited about next weekend. So the 17th, I think it is. It's Friday? Yeah, I'm actually really excited. Now, my show, by the way, is Canadian music. So that's what I do a focus on. That is what I play. I just play Canadian-only music. But I'm super in love with this band called X-Hex. That would be Mary Timoney's newest band. Now, Mary Timoney most recently was in the band Wild Flag with Carrie Brownstein, Janet Weiss, etc. And that band sadly broke up, which is a shame because I'm a huge Wild Flag fan as well. And then prior to that, Mary Timoney, most notably known for being in Helium, so back in the 90s. And what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, so X-Hex. So she's in a new three-piece band. New three-piece band called X-Hex, and they are playing, I want to say, at the Electric Owl. I think that's where it's at. It's a week from Friday, and you have to go. This new record is called, I want to say it's called Rips. I think that's what it's called. It was just released, and I can't play it here because my show is Canadian. But it's amazing. It's like killer. And I'm just super excited. And some of the best stuff I've heard in a long time. So go check that out. That's Friday of next weekend. And then on the 18th, that would be the next night. So Saturday, the 18th, I believe, is the inaugural show at the Hindenburg, which is this new upcoming, like it's the first show. I believe it might be, I want to say Gastown. People have told me where it was and my memory seems to lead me somewhere in Gastown. Oh, actually, I think it is. I think it's like the site of some really old club. Maybe the Smiling Buddha. I wasn't in Vancouver back then. Yeah, and at the Hindenburg that night is going to be my friend's band. So my friend is in the... Actually, a few of my friends are in that band called High Waisted. High Waisted. And so you should go check that out. They're going to be opening for... I should know this. The Manipulators and who's the other band now on that bill? What? Regardless, it looks like a really good show. Vicious Cycles. That's what it is. So go check that show out. All right. What else can I tell you? I don't know. Oh, yeah. Lady Hawk. That's what we're going to play next. So keep tuning in. I'm here until 8. And Lady Hawk put this record out entitled, I believe it's No Can Do. Yes. A couple of years ago. I can't believe it's 2012 this record was put out. It seems like yesterday. It really does. We're going to hear the title track from No Can Do. Lady Hawker, local band, of course. And they are on... Oh, wait a second. This one was released on Triple Crown Audio Recordings. But prior to that, they'd been on Jag Jaguar out of Indiana. Yeah. How am I doing here? I can figure this out. Okay, so here we go. This is Lady Hawk. The station, of course, is CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. This is the title track from the record, and it's coming on any second. I'm just going to keep talking at you until we're good here. Here we go, I think. Jesus, this is why. There we go. Let me try that again, folks. Lady Hawk.
living in the city, and sugar, things are looking pretty. And if I say that you are mine, oh honey, we'll be here till the end of time. And if you say you walk in my shoes, try it out then, baby, school me with the news. And if I say that you are cute, without you, baby, I'll be turning blue. Cruising down Commercial Drive, see the gang and flash them all a high five. Hold us up, we got a hot date. Check the mirror, man, don't wanna be late. See that lady walking with the tassels? Don't you know I'm the king?